Hello and welcome to AIPT Comics Podcast, episode 59. My name is David Brook, and I'm here with Forrest Hollingsworth. We're going to talk about comics for an hour or more.
Or more, but not less. Although maybe less, because we do have Cy Spurrier and Christian Wildgoose, and they talk quite a bit about comics, especially their new comic, Alienated Number 1, out from Boom this week.
Yeah, we're going to be talking that comic, their careers, writing, etc., etc. That's later in the show. So it's not just us knuckleheads. We've got actual comic talent on. Unless you mean funny comic, in which case, I'm your man. On this show, we talk about the latest comic book news to keep you up to date and connected. And we start with the news. In the top of our news, there is a lot of Empire. That is the new Marvel event coming out starting in April.
Yes.
Empire news to talk about. Are you excited for Empire, Forrest?
I was telling you just off the air that Empire makes me feel kind of dumb.
Why is that?
Like, I've been reading Marvel comics consistently for like 10 years. I've been reviewing comics since like 2011, I think. And there's a ton of characters on these Empire books, especially one of the ones that we have here. It was a fantastic cover by Rod Reese, but it's called Lord of Empire Celestial Messiah. And the solicit is implying that I should already know this character.
Yeah.
And I do not know this character. And I feel dumb, for lack of a better word.
I have a feeling it's going to be a brand new character, because I agree with you. I don't know who this is.
It has to be, right?
Yeah. And then he's got some sort of ceremonial garb on.
Yeah.
This is an exclusive that ran on AIPTComics.com.
Mantis is in this one, so I know that character.
It's also the second issue in the Lords of Empire tie-in series. I feel like this is going to be like Web of Venom, in that it'll probably be a one-shot that gives you some insight into a character who plays into the bigger story. But yeah, I don't know who this character is. Here's the thing that I have with Empire. This is my take.
Okay.
We just had a war event last year with War of the Realms.
Yes.
We're going to go right into another war. And that wasn't just any war. There was a foreign agent, the elf dude, I forget his name now.
Yeah.
Coming to Earth to try to kill all of humanity or take it over or whatever. And now again, we have Hulkling and whatever his deal is coming to Earth to do the same thing.
Sure. I mean, obviously we're not in the throes of Empire yet, so I don't know what it's going to turn out to be, but I think you're very much right that War of the Realms was just this idea for Thor.
Right.
And this is just that idea for Avengers and Fantastic Four.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird. It's like they're trying to justify the Fantastic Four's return,
mm-hmm.
because that solo series, or I guess it's not solo, there's 4 to 6 of them at any given time, has been kind of lackluster. So they're trying to, like, foist them into the mainstream or into the collective consciousness of Marvel through events, which they do too frequently.
Right.
And I just kind of, eh.
Right. I am excited for, you know, any surprises that Marvel throws at us. I mean, for instance, Mark Waid's Squadron Supreme was announced.
Sure, yeah.
And the take on this, where they're, like, the Avengers for the U.S. government, especially considering the political climate these days, this could be a really great way to do a little, you know, social commentary on our society.
I like that it's like the group is comprised of Hyperion, Power Princess, Dr. Spectrum, Blur, and Nighthawk, with the latter serving as the team leader, which sounds rad, and the art is rad. Really fantastic covers by Paco Medina and Ed McGuinness. And then they work alongside U.S. government liaison Phil Coulson.
Yeah.
Neat! Heroes!
Now, I don't know if this is still the case, but if you were reading Avengers like a year ago, we found out that Mephisto was like messing around with him.
Oh, okay. So that's kind of the bigger story here.
The Mephisto part?
Across all of Marvel right now, right? Mephisto made a deal with Otto Octavius recently. He made a deal with Miles Morales.
Mm-hmm.
He showed up in Venom. He's showing up in some... I'm assuming he'll show up in some Empire.
He was a little bit in the Cosmic Ghost Rider story.
So I'm kind of here for whatever that event is. Mm-hmm. Because I love Mephisto as a character. And also because it's not coming out of nowhere like I feel like Incoming and Empire kind of did.
Right, right, right. We're still waiting for Incoming to mean something.
Right.
By the way.
And I just kind of feel like it's true to Mephisto's character to see him putting all the pieces on the chessboard.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that whoever is coordinating that event really gets the character.
Right.
So that's exciting to me without even... That's a nebulous, unannounced event that I'm more excited for than Empire.
The deep, dark underbelly.
Right. Yeah.
Also this week, Marvel's pull list revealed a bunch of solicitations, as they do mid-month every month these days.
Yes.
And amongst those are more Empire tie-ins, or also Empire number 3 solicitation. Mm-hmm. So if you go to aptcomics.com, you can read those and see the art. Empire number 3 suggests there's an long-lost Avenger returns to active duty. Who could it be? On the cover, it looks like Mar-Vell, maybe?
Oh, interesting. I hadn't even considered that.
That's what it looks like. Anyway, but I mean, for all we know, it's not the guy's not, or girl isn't on the cover. It could be
right,
anybody.
Right, right, yeah. I do think that this Captain Marvel number 18 book, written by Kelly Thompson with art by Corey Smith and a fantastic cover by Jorge Molina, Captain Marvel is holding up Ronan the Accuser's hammer with lightning striking down behind her, and it says Captain Marvel is the Supreme Accuser. And that's just cool.
Yeah, especially with Captain Marvel recently kind of having
a heel turn. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The light, the color, and by extension, the lighting on this is just insane.
We're going to talk about this to death. We always talk about this, but the other tie-ins are like Agents of Wakanda, Savage Avengers, those kinds of books, and it's just like so exhausting for an event to take over the entire line.
Yep.
And they said that they weren't going to do that with War of the Realms.
I know, and there were, what, 80, 90 tie-ins?
On any given week.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I hate to be... I feel like I'm always complaining lately, but I don't know. I hope it's good. I have a lot of faith in Al Ewing. I thought his Guardians of the Galaxy number 1 was a fantastic reinvigoration of that book and those characters. So I have faith in what he can do. And I hope that him and Slott are collaborating very closely to make it all make sense and to make it true to the characters and stuff. It could be very, very exciting and very cool.
I'm nervous. I don't have that much interest yet. I don't know what's really going on yet. And we're only a month away.
Sure. I kind of feel that way only because it's making me feel dumb, like I previously mentioned.
Right, right, right.
But I obviously I'm gonna check this out, so whatever.
Also in Marvel solicitation news, The Marvels number 1 is coming May 2020 from Kurt.
Man, this looks so cool.
Kurt Busiek, Will Durey, Sinar, and of course covers by Alex Ross.
Yes.
This is fascinating to me because it appears to be mixing all Marvel characters across time. We've got Arrow on the cover, obviously Spider-Man, Captain America, but also Arcus, the Vision, the original Vision or whatever, this character that's Golden Age Vision is what he was called at the time. But this is an interesting blending of characters. And then, of course, we've got Kurt Busiek behind the wheel, who's, of course, so acclaimed for Astro City and, of course, his series Marvels with Alex Ross.
Yes. And I want to add... a fantastic interview. He's very kind. He has a lot of interesting stories. When we got into, I interviewed him for Spider-Man Month for Untold Tales of Spider-Man, and I was just awestruck by his understanding of Marvel history, the way he contextualizes it, the way he finds with like scalpel-like precision stories to tell between characters or between major arcs.
Right.
And so like, obviously Marvels is amazing and The Marvels is going to be equally amazing, I think. I also love, there's a thing in here that says, plus, or what is Kashum?
Oh my god, this is the long-lost Avenger that we were just talking about. It's going to appear, no, wait, that's a separate thing entirely.
K-S-H-O-O-M.
That's quite a name.
And I really hope it's just like Man-Thing wearing a hat.
Yeah, okay.
You know,
it reminds me of like Fing Fang Foom.
Yes, yeah, yeah, for sure. It just any of those kooky, weird B horror characters.
Right, right. Yeah, this should be a lot of fun. I'm excited for it. I hope it's not part of the main universe, because then we that way we don't have to worry about it connecting to Empire or whatever.
Yeah, that's true. Marvel's has kind of always, like I said, existed in the in-between spaces.
So the in-between.
Yeah.
Is that going to be in Stranger Things season 4?
I'm sure that they found a nice niche to tell their story in.
Dustin, don't go to the in-between.
Oh, man.
We must stay in the underground. Wait. Under, what is it? Under?
Upside down.
Upside down. Yeah. Not the in-between.
The underground.
In the in-between, Dustin's we must eat Eggos by
Dustin's
folding
in the backyard
them.
Just putting dirt on himself.
I think this next bit of news is going to make Forrest put dirt on himself.
Man, we really set up these show notes to just make me complain.
Look, Bleeding Cool has announced, not announced, because it's not really official, just official, but they have new details on Death Metal, Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo's upcoming event. And in this article on BleedingCool.com, there's a whole lot of art that hasn't been revealed yet, splashed with Bleeding Cool watermarks. So I assume this is the first time it's ever been seen. I don't know how he got it, but there's some interesting stuff in here that kind of gives us details on what is coming. For instance, like Harley Quinn has a giant hyena.
Yep.
And there's like a Batman who's like got like tentacles. Mm-hmm. And it appears that Batman Who Laughs is like involved with,
yeah,
like they're all kind of hanging out.
I mean, it looks a lot like he's kind of making a proposition to a like a group of villains here.
Right.
In front of some destroyed city or castle.
And then there's plenty of art that's been released already officially, like Superman in his brass knuckles and Batman on a motorcycle that's made out of some weird bat bones.
Yeah.
And we've talked on the show previously about Wonder Woman's
chainsaw.
Lasso. Chainsaw of Truth.
You know that famous thing where Wonder Woman, she can't keep away from it. She always goes back to the chainsaw. And you're really excited when Wonder Woman gets her famous signature chainsaw.
When she saws you, do you think you like some truthness happens? Like,
truth
how does
spills
that
out of you. And it's sticky and red.
I saw you tweeted you were annoyed by the brass knuckles.
Yeah, I was.
He's got like a Darkseid arm.
He does. And okay. So let's zoom out a little bit because you saw my tweet. And also Donny Cates saw my tweet and retweeted my tweet, which said, why the fuck would Superman need brass knuckles?
Yeah.
And then I got a bunch of people. I'm a nerd. You're a nerd.
Sure.
I'm cool with nerds. I got a bunch of nerds in my mentions on Twitter all week. People going, actually, it's Nth Metal.
Okay.
And I'm just kind of like, that's not the point.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's some sort of dampening thing or control thing for his weird hulked out arm.
Right.
Cool. Right, it's right, just right. Like the idea of advertising these characters that are explicitly not this in a way that's meant to undermine your expectations for them, in a way that's meant to be really edgy. I think I said the same thing recently about Wonder Woman's chainsaw, and if I didn't, I feel the same way about it as I do with Superman's brass nth metal knuckles and his chain belt.
Yeah.
Which is just like, it's not Superman.
No.
And sure, there's the idea that's like, well, he's going to his extremes. But in no permutation in my mind do I see Clark Kent doing that.
No.
Right? And so, and especially with Wonder Woman, where Steve Orlando is trying to tell a really interesting, in-depth, emotive story about the lack of violence, about fighting violence with compassion and stuff in the mainline Wonder Woman story or book right now. And Snyder's just over here like, yeah, but what if she had a chainsaw?
Right.
And DC is like, let's advertise both.
Right.
It's a matter of personal preference, and it doesn't appeal to me because it's not what these characters are meant to idealize.
Two things. One, DC is so erratic the last couple of years that it doesn't surprise me that so many polar opposites could be happening at once.
Yeah.
I mean, that includes that other Wonder Woman series where she's in the far future and she's the only hero left.
Daniel Warren Johnson's Dead Earth.
Right, which is DC Black
Label. But that's Black Label, right.
We don't know if this is Black Label. It may be, I suppose. It's possible, but
I mean, Metal wasn't. Dark Knights wasn't. None of that stuff was. And this is Capullo and Snyder's final big event. It's their final ever. It ties everything together. It's hard for me to believe that they're going to make it Black Label when everything else was not Black Label.
It's almost like the directors of Fast and the Furious are producing this while meanwhile, it's like the Downton Abbey directors are working on Wonder Woman on her own solo title. You know what I mean? Like serious and getting gritty with character, whereas this is just balls to the wall, crazy, nonsensical fun.
With no kind of editorial oversight to say like, hey, this is happening then. And this is happening now.
I mean, stuff is just in the last year, stuff has been happening. I don't know when anything is occurring.
I have no idea what the fuck's going on, to be honest. Yeah. And then Snyder also tweeted, for those asking, the cliffhanger in Justice League goes straight into this project. You won't need to read anything before picking it up, though. We just needed a bigger stage to make a final, all-encompassing saga that links many DC stories, past and present, in the biggest showdown possible. Which, to me, it sounds like a pretty impassioned argument that this is canon.
Right.
Or at least Snyder's canon. And that's even more confusing.
It is. I said this on the show when I was talking about that his final Justice League issue. It bothers me that it didn't say, to be continued in Death Metal.
And they started advertising it the next week.
That day.
You're right. It was that day. Mm-hmm. Wow.
And I don't know, maybe it's because they didn't figure out the title yet at the time. It's still, like, the way that last page ended, I actually emailed the PR guy who sends us access to these issues early so we can review them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is there a problem with the digital copy? Because this can't be the ending, right?
Right. And he's like, no, and that's the ending. I mean, it's not.
So Scott Snyder tweeted, goals for DC Death Metal.
You're right.
Make you care through big heartfelt moments, make it all connect, make you what the fuck, give you way more than you pay for, make you cheer, make it us, not yours and ours, and finally, rock the fuck out and have some fun doing it because why not, nothing left to prove. Which is, I think this bulleted list is telling in a couple ways. One, he's typically given us way more than we pay for, I think.
I think that's true. His books are
just packed with stuff and ideas.
Yep.
So much so that it could actually hurt the book. But that's neither here nor there. I mean, this tweet is basically telling me, you know, canon doesn't matter on a certain level. They're just going all out for fun's sake.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not that's a good idea, I guess it depends on the fan. Because, let's be honest, you could just read Wonder Woman series and just not even pick this up.
Absolutely.
It probably wouldn't matter.
I mean, DC is kind of always been the company that it's like, it's all about your headcanon.
Sure.
They publish a lot of niche stories or solo titles alongside books like Justice League, and the depictions in those books don't match up at all. I mean, Steve Orlando and Riley Rossmo's Martian Manhunter does not match up with the character in Justice League.
Right. I mean, he was dead for a little while.
Right. I mean, and that's fine. Whatever. I really like Steve Orlando and Riley Rossmo, and I like that book a lot. A lot, a lot.
Yeah.
So whatever. And I can just say, well, that's my Martian Manhunter.
Exactly.
And that's fine. People should read what they want to read and like what they want to like.
I do see your point, though. Like, is this series, just that it exists, an insult to the other series?
I think it's just, yes. It feels that way to me. And I feel like it feels that way because Snyder and Capullo are such a tried and true team. They have done a lot of amazing work. I love Court of Owls. I think it's one of the best Batman stories of all time. But they just clearly have a blank check from DC now.
Oh, you mean they can do whatever they want?
Do whatever they want. They have carte blanche.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And it shows, I think, a fundamental lack of teamwork or understanding. From editorial.
Yeah.
To not, you know, try and make these stories or their themes or their characters cohesive.
You know Bendis is just going to do whatever the hell he wants while this is happening.
He's doing whatever the fuck he wants. Yeah.
I don't know if I mentioned this on a previous episode, but he did an Action Comics that tied into Justice League at the time.
Uh-huh.
And it basically made the point that the entire Legion of Doom is pathetic in comparison to Leviathan. He could defeat them all. He's better. They're actually wowed by him and like amazed at how great he is. And it just, the entire thing felt like a middle finger to Scott Snyder, in my opinion.
Right. And that's where you need the editorial oversight, I think.
Right. And then you have these problems where if you're a reader who reads it all, you're just
confused.
Shit out of luck. Like, what do you do now?
What's weird is that I think you equally understand DC way better than, like, I do.
Uh-huh.
But also, you're very confused.
Oh, for sure.
And that's so telling for you in particular, but also, like, for Ritesh, for Vishal, for another number of great writers we have at AIPTComics.com that are saying, like, oh, yeah, just pick the stuff that you think matters.
Right, right.
Whatever.
I will say that's one thing Marvel gets right with their events.
Yeah.
It keeps us focused and it makes us understand where all the pieces lie at once.
Yep.
Whereas I don't, the last like four events at DC, I don't know what the hell's happening with anybody. Like, one minute Harley's dead, the next minute she's on a team. Who knows? To continue this thread, in our next bit of news, Tom King came out and revealed an aborted, as Newsarama calls it, because we got this news from Newsarama, New 52 Superboy title that he was going to do with Kenneth Rocafort.
Yeah.
And it's yet another, it's interesting that he's doing this because in a way it's like, hey, check out this cool thing that editorial didn't let me do or whatever.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
We don't actually know why it didn't come about, but at the same time, it is like hinting at like this cool thing that he could have done but never did.
And kind of a direct parallel to the Young Justice series, the animated series.
Right, so right,
that's
right.
Interesting as well.
There's some interesting art of Superboy and what is this character?
Miss Martian. Yeah.
Yes. What do you think of the news?
I think it's interesting. I think it, it says here, the writer made his DC debut during the tail end of New 52 with a short in a 2013 Vertigo anthology. But, I mean, this is, like, to the point where they had pitch art, they had costumes, they had this is going to tie into Young Justice and stuff, which implies to me that DC was all in on Tom King a lot sooner than I knew about or anticipated.
That's true.
It's neat. I really liked Jeff Lemire's Superboy, which actually someone in the comments mentions. It was sadly canceled far too soon due to Flashpoint. That was a fantastic series. And I think Superboy can be a really interesting character in the right hands.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know for Tom King if that looks like one of his solo books. Mr. Miracle, Adam Strange, The Vision, whatever it is that he exceeds in. And maybe he just didn't have a strong enough pitch for this. Or maybe New 52 was kind of already petering out. Whatever.
Right, yeah. Yeah. The line shifted, maybe.
Yeah.
You know what else shifts? Release dates.
Woo, boy!
J.J. and Henry Abrams' Spider-Man series is getting postponed again, and it will now be postponed 4 full months from when it was supposed to be
buck
released.
Buck wild. Especially after we talked about, I feel, quite a bit in our Year in Review episode where this is DC's problem and not Marvel's problem.
Mm-hmm.
Man, Spider-Man number 4 was originally solicited to arrive December 11th, but was pushed back to February 19th and now has an April 8th release date. And Spider-Man number 5, the miniseries finale, is scheduled for May 27th after being scheduled for January 29th and April 15th.
So,
which is to say,
yeah,
that this was already supposed to be over.
Right. Thank God Nick Lowe didn't come out and say, the entire Spider-Man universe will be affected by this.
Yeah.
I'm talking about Doomsday Clock.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And you cannot believe, you know.
Yeah. I do want to say, like, by way of kind of backtracking what we had said at the time.
Yeah.
And maybe eating crow a little bit, like, I am perpetually annoyed by editors being like, this is a dream project, or we've talked to this writer forever. And they've had drafts and they showed us all their ideas and we were so excited, but it's taken like 5 years to get it together or whatever. I had major concerns about that with relation to Jonathan Hickman taking over X-Men.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Because, Jordan D. White had said, you know, we've been talking with Hickman for years at this point, and that doesn't really tell me anything.
Right.
I was totally wrong in relation to Dawn of X, House of X. They're fantastic books. They still are. And he's doing a great job in the kind of weird middle ground between editor and writer.
Mm-hmm.
But this kind of delay, this Spider-Man delay with J.J. Abrams, is the other side of the coin.
Right.
In that this is what we were worried about, and this is what we were talking about. It's like me and J.J. have been working for 5 years to get this story out. So why wasn't it just done before you released the first one?
Yeah, he put a lot of pressure on himself and the series by hyping it as much as he did.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's obviously a vanity project, and that's fine, whatever. But
they should have just released it as a graphic novel.
They should have just put it out as a graphic novel, absolutely.
And yeah, sure, it might not have sold as much, but at this point, it's become a problem.
It's problematic. It makes Marvel look bad. It makes Nick look bad. It makes Sarah Pacelli look bad. It makes J.J. Abrams and his son look bad.
Luckily, it's a mess. Marvel, you know, Marvel doesn't have to worry too much because I don't think that many people care about this book at all.
No, they don't. And I guess my final word on it, because it'll come out and whatever, I read the first two issues, is if it took you 5 years on and off to even get JJ into the room, why on earth did you think this book was going to be done on time?
Well, Nick Lowe did say it took that long to make the contract. Maybe in the contract it said, I get to take as much time as I want between
issues. I guess. It must have. I have no idea why you think when someone is that busy or that unavailable, you think you're going to get a book out on time or schedule dates in that quick of succession. It's weird.
He's probably like 80-hour weeks right now with Warner Brothers after making that deal with them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure he was, you know...
coaching
Kylo and Daisy to kiss or whatever the fuck.
Do you know Romeo and Juliet? God. It's great. Sorry, that's a Star Wars joke. What bothers me the most when I saw this news was I feel bad for Sarah Pacelli.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I haven't seen much Sarah Pacelli work right now, and it's probably because, you know, she's stuck, you know, in a holding pattern.
Well, it's like the
pages.
Artist on Three Jokers.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Yeah.
What's it? Robson Rocha, I think?
I can't remember.
Yeah.
Right now.
Well, it's unfortunate, but, you know, we'll get there. We'll get there.
We're going to make it through together.
We just need to hold hands.
Man, I'm sorry. I feel very whiny, but I just, you know, sometimes we talk about how we love comics, and I love comics. I'm really excited to talk to Cy and Christian later. I also loved their book. I'm really positive about a bunch of stuff that came out this week. But, man, sometimes the industry itself can be exhausting.
In our next segment, Top Books of Last Week,
we're going to talk about stuff.
Our two favorite comics
out last week. Yeah.
The best of the best. To start this segment, we always talk about comicbookroundup.com's top critic and fan pick. Note, these picks were chosen on Wednesday, so they might fluctuate by the time you listen to this on Sunday.
But it is kind of interesting. We don't normally record on Wednesday. I love seeing the books that people are hot about on New Comic Book Day.
That's true.
You know, like the ones that are an immediate 9.9, immediate 10, or whatever. It's cool. That means that those people wanted to read those books first.
These are the passion picks of the week. The top critic pick is Green Lantern Season 2, number 1, by Grant Morrison and Liam Sharp. And the fan pick is Hawkeye Freefall, number 3, by Matthew Rosenberg and Otto Schmidt.
So, but why though CJ gave Green Lantern Season 2, number 1, a 10 out of 10 and said the Green Lantern Season 2, number 1, that's a mouthful. It's not only a perfect jumping on point for new readers, but it also manages to set up a new story for Hal utilizing existing mythology. I can't wait to see where Morrison, Sharp, and Olaf go from here. And then for Hawkeye Freefall number 3, Above Ground Pool says, another perfect issue. Favorite current book.
I love the reviews that are short this week.
I love fan reviews that just say, great!
The freaking art by Liam Sharp is out of this world.
Is it?
It's so detailed and organic and weird and alien, and it's perfect for this kind of book.
I'm very surprised by how well Matthew Rosenberg gets Hawkeye.
Mm.
How much he gets Clint Barton.
Yeah, the attitude's perfect.
And the kind of Clint that existed in, you know, Matt Fraction's famous run.
That's a fun book.
And not Jeremy Renner's adaptation of the character. It's a great book. It's a book everyone should be reading.
What is your second great book of last week?
My second favorite book of last week is Undone by Blood number 1, written by Lonnie Nadler and Zach Thompson, with art by Sammy Cavella. This is a new Boom comic. We had Lonnie and Zach on the podcast last week to talk about it. I love its meta-fictional, meta-narrative dissection of Westerns as a genre, and also the specific characters that are allowed to exist in Westerns and not many other genres, where you just accept that a character is on a revenge quest or on a quest for gold or whatever it might be. Or on the other side of it, that a character is totally disillusioned with those things and that you don't need a ton of backstory to make it work. Lonnie and Zach really, really get that. They are telling a fantastic story, I think, about the romanticized ideals of Westerns and then also the realities of Westerns. The main character, for example, gets into a fist fight and gets beat the fuck up and tossed out into the street. Just like would probably happen if you were looking for revenge against a gang in a saloon.
Yeah.
You know? So I like the dichotomy that's happening in this book. I think it's very, very smart, but also just very fun to read page to page.
I like the pulp fiction of it.
Yes. Yeah.
If you want to hear more about this title, I recommend listening to our last episode. We had Lonnie and Zach on.
Yep.
To talk about this book. My second favorite book of last week was Batman's Grave number 5 by Warren Ellis and Brian Hitch with colors by Alex Sinclair. Okay. I'm not going to lie to you. One of the biggest reasons why I like this series is because of how brutal Batman is. This dude strikes to put people down. Which makes a lot of sense because if, you know, you're Batman, you don't want to waste time, you know, kicking and punching and doing backflips. You are knocking people out. And Hitch is drawing some amazing choreography here. He's pretty much well known for, you know, big bombastic art where there's, you know, splashy pages and characters flying around. And I didn't know he was this good at choreography in his fight scenes. This issue takes place in Arkham Asylum. There is a mystery afoot. It opens beautifully. Commissioner Gordon is like, oh my God, I have information that Batman doesn't have. I'm totally going to brag about it when I see him. And it ends with, I won't tell you the ending, but it ends in a way where Gordon's like, oh crap.
Yeah.
It's a series also that I think would translate really well to a TV show.
I think Ellis is really good at that.
I'm a huge fan of Transmetropolitan. Yes. It's probably my top three books.
I'm a huge fan of Castlevania.
Yeah, you are. Yeah, that's true. We were just that was off the air. We were talking about
my crush on Alucard. Yeah,
yeah, that's right.
It's all right. We can air it out. It's fine.
I mean, it is Valentine's Day weekend.
Yeah, all right.
Oh my God, maybe it's Valentine's month like Halloween.
Watch the horny vampire show with the people you love.
There you go. So yeah, this is kind of a no-brainer. I'm sure the people who love Batman are probably reading it. And both the creators, all three of the artists and creators on this are phenomenal. So check it out.
Yeah, I ended up deciding that I wanted to read this in trade. And I hope that they put it out in like a nice hardcover or anything because I'm already sold on it.
I wonder if they'll put it out in 6 or 12 issues because it is a 12 issue.
It is, yeah. We'll see. I like how they're printing like the Black Label stuff. So
what is your number one pick of last week?
Do you want to talk about our number one pick together?
Oh, baby. I wish I could hold your hand. Our number one pick of last week is Alien and Number One by Cy Spurrier and Chris Wildgoose. Not because they're on the show later, because we love it.
Yes. We had them on the show because we loved it.
That's true. We actually read the book. We thought about it for 3 months and said, we will have them on.
We will permit Forrest's favorite writer from 2019 to be on the podcast.
We actually asked Cy to pitch us this story before we even pitched it to Boom.
That's right.
Before we allowed him to be on the show, before the show even existed. So this book is really good at character writing. It's really good at setting up its premise. It's really good at capturing each personality, which we will get into in the interview later.
Yeah. But for to zoom out just a second, it's a story of three kids, all named Sam, all alienated from their small middle America community and also their school in different ways, who find an unexpected, alien in the woods. Mm-hmm. And then kind of get to know each other much better from there.
Yeah, they bond.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's funny is when I cracked this book open and there's a scene in the first two pages where this character is doing like a YouTube show with a mask.
Right, yeah.
And later we get to see like the best version of this, some popular guy who does this, where he does these like almost like punked live art things.
It's like anonymous Alex Jones type shit.
It made me think of this podcast.
Did it?
Because we're trying to like create an audience and build up our listens. And so is this main character, Sam.
And we also pull pranks on people all the time.
And we go to the park and we touch things and sometimes we feel funny. Just like in this story.
Yeah. It's a fantastic book. I was really surprised by how well it... I grew up in a very small rural community in Washington State. And I was really surprised by how well a British writer and artist captured and kind of emulated like my experience with small towns and with small town schools and stuff. there's a kid who is acting out. He's homophobic, he's rude, he's violent, and everyone has just kind of decided that there's no real way to, like, fix his attitude. One kid earnestly tries, but also gives up, and just accepts that that's the way he is. Either because that's how the community molded him, or because that's how his parents molded him, or his lack of parents molded him, or his dissatisfaction with the school system has molded him. And I knew that kid. And I had the same kinds of frustrations as the students, or the three Sams in this book had with my community and with my school and with my friends and with communicating with people and stuff. It was deeply, deeply relatable to me, in a way that it makes me think, you know, in a sense, we are all kind of living in small town America globally.
Oh, sure. That makes sense.
It's very deep, and it's very satisfying. It's very honest for a book about a alien super predator being found in the woods. And obviously,
it's oh so cute too.
Yeah, it's adorable. It's like a Mayan cat alien. It's just the way that Psy balances those two things, like the extremes of the sci-fi genre and horror genre with just like teenage mundanity. It's really, really interesting. And I think it succeeds better at that idea than maybe Stranger Things does.
Boom Studios is on a roll, man.
Yeah.
They've got so many great creator owns. I mean, they've got some of the best talent too. They must be putting out some good contracts to attract these creators to bring some of the best ideas.
Some of their
they
best
have.
Work, yeah.
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 So yeah, check out Alienated before everybody else does. So actually, I don't know if you read the news, but Alienated Morn already sold out before it reached comic stores. So you might not be able to find it for a few weeks until the second printing gets released.
And I'm certain that it will have third printings, fourth printings. Oh, yeah. It's very, very good.
Or go to comicsology.com and pick it up there.
Yep.
In our next segment, Top Books for Next Week, we talk about our top pick coming out. We haven't read it yet, but we want to read it, and we can't wait, and we have all these reasons why we like it and want it, and we know that it'll be good. What is your top book for next week?
My top book for next week is Skull Digger plus Skeleton Boy number 3 with art by Jeff Lemire and art written by Jeff Lemire. Written by Jeff Lemire with art by Tansy Janjic. I have really enjoyed the Skull Digger and Skeleton Boy books, especially for someone that isn't caught up on Black Hammer or the Black Hammer Extended Universe. They're fun, they're violent, there's this kind of weird budding relationship between Skull Boy and or Skeleton Boy and Skull Digger. And it's very, very interesting, and it takes kind of the what if there was a Punisher Junior idea and elevates it very well, artistically and narratively.
Punisher Junior.
Yeah.
I need to read that book.
For kids.
Punisher Junior. Right. For Saturday morning cartoons. Would he kill? He probably couldn't kill. I mean,
he would knock out.
He would knock them out. Yeah. He would put them in sleeper holds.
Or he would kill people in like really insanely brutal ways. And then they would be like, it's Kool-Aid.
Like a commercial?
He's full of confetti.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. It was like a cartoon. Yeah.
Like a cartoon.
You know what's not like a cartoon? Joker Killer Smile number 3 by Jeff Lemire and Andrea Sorrentino. This is my top book of next week because it is the last issue in the 3-issue DC Black Label series. This book is exercised, and it needs to be because Sorrentino's art is insane, as it always is. The creativity that he brings to this book is just bonkers.
That's funny. Yeah. I was going to say, you know that Andrea Sorrentino, I think he's a good artist.
Oh, yeah.
I think I'm getting an inkling.
There is a level of storytelling that is just above and beyond most comic book artists. It's borderline like fine art.
Yes,
I agree. Some of these pages. Yep. And the story is quite good, too. It's following a psychiatrist who has been interviewing Joker, trying to write like an expose or book about him, and he thinks he can crack him. Everyone tells him in the beginning, you're crazy, stop interviewing him. And I think in the second issue, we find out that he thought he's only been interviewing Joker for 3 weeks, and it's been 3 months.
Okay.
And he didn't know that. So something's going on. So I'm ready for the payday on this. I want to get all the answers. I love
that kooky, crazy character, the Joker.
You know, one of these days he's going to break in and people are going to like
it.
He's
going to get big. I was implying that I'm exhausted by the Joker character, but I am surprisingly not exhausted by the Joker character in Jeff Lemire's hands. So
yeah, it's very good comic storytelling.
Yep.
In our next segment, judging by the cover, Junior. Punisher Junior. Throw that in there.
He drags it onto the screen for us. Or yes. We do a segment where he kicks Judging by the Cover Junior off a roof and it lands right in front of our view.
And we hear a neck snap.
Right, yeah.
This is where we get to talk about cover art, which is not talked about as much as it should because it sells those books, baby. Mm-hmm. And my favorite cover art, if I can go first.
You can.
Is Ghost Spider number 7 by Paul Pope. Paul Pope is fantastic. Been around for a while. We haven't seen Paul Pope do a lot recently, and I'm glad to see his work here. This is a crazy good cover because it gets the anatomy really well mm-hmm. on Gwen Stacy. She's holding a web, two webs, and she's sort of, what is she? She's hanging vertically and bending backwards. I think there's some accentuation of the ballerina slipper she's wearing. It feels very much like a ballerina pose.
I mean, that's true of the character.
Exactly. And what's interesting to me, too, is typically we see her from the front, and we're getting her from the back here. And a lot of the costume isn't as displayed as it usually is, including her hood, which is dangling down. And yet I still get that cool vibe from her costume from this side angle.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I love when characters look realistic. You know, she doesn't have giant boobs or giant butt or even giant feet or anything. It looks really good.
It's using the space really cool, too.
Yes.
I mean, obviously the comic cover is vertical.
I love the verticality. Yeah.
It's pretty sweet. What is your favorite cover?
My favorite cover is The Red Mother number 3. The cover art is also by the author and artist, Jeremy Kwan. I love the way that this cover deals with depth. You've got a kind of fully rendered 3D looking main character in the background, but in the foreground is a very simplistic plain line red drawing of a kind of alien or steampunk heart above her face. And the kind of depth that it creates, the distance that it creates from the background characters, she is kind of fading into insanity throughout the series. And also the way that this more simplistic line work is coming out of her fully rendered red eye is really well done.
Yes, it's very cool. I saw Jeremy Hahn do some sketches on Twitter showing the inking of an incredible cover of a cityscape.
Mm.
And it's just a reminder, inkers don't get enough credit, man.
No, they absolutely not. Yeah.
Hours upon hours putting detail into these pages.
Yep.
If I were them, I'd be like, can I just do this faster? Can I just dump ink on the page and somehow it'll work? Yeah. Well, that's it for that segment. In our next segment, we will be interviewing Cy Spurrier and Christian Wildgoose about Alienated. It's out now this week. And enjoy. On with us is Cy Spurrier and Chris Wildgoose. They are coming out with Alienated number 1 on February 12th from Boom Studios. Thank you guys so much for being on the show.
Great pleasure.
Hey, thanks for having us.
First and foremost, I love the premise of Alienated. When you were building out from this idea, was the setting always high school students?
Yeah, I think so, pretty much. I mean, it's sort of, it began, I guess, with a sort of fascination with responsibility and you know, the kind of the meaty themes that so many comics are interested in, the sort of the obvious with great power comes great responsibility thing springs to mind. But I've always been fascinated by E.T. and the idea that we are now quite familiar, all of us, with that essential story unit of a young person discovering something otherworldly, something ineffable and strange, and then figuring out what to do about it. And because we as consumers are all hardwired to want our heroes to be wide-eyed and innocent and to sort of see a reflection of ourselves and the best in ourselves, often the person who finds this strange dollop of sci-fi in the woods is going to be your classic middle America Goody Two Shoes, Boy Scout, Everyman. Mm.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to teach us what we should be doing and how we should feel, and we'll all be heartwarmed, and there'll be choirs of angels and twinkly light, and it's just bollocks, isn't it? It's a big pile of bollocks. Basically, a real discovery of something amazing like that would change your life. It would change anybody's life. And I'm fascinated with the idea that all of us in our lives have a sort of idea about what we might do to change the world if we could just snap our fingers and change it. But the most interesting people to ask these questions to are teenagers, because they are young and angry, and they are going to inherit the world, and we're doing it wrong, and they know we're doing it wrong. And so they've got big ideas, and they've got big emotion, but they've got not very much experience. And that's a set of ingredients that makes for some really amazing stories. So that's a very long-winded way of saying, when you are trying to tell a story about what would a human being do if they suddenly found themselves with the opportunity to change the world, the best and most interesting stories would always revolve around young people. And so, yeah, it was always going to be about a bunch of high school kids finding an alien in the woods.
That makes sense.
So, similar to E.T., Alienated lives in the middle ground between, like, sci-fi horror and mundane teen drama. Was there other media, books, movies, games that influenced either the narrative or the visuals?
I'm going to flick this one to you, Chris, first.
Oh, God. Like, I'm always quite a big fan of, like, teen drama-y sort of stuff. Like, especially for this, I've kind of wanted to, I think Si has mentioned it before, but like it'd be a bit timeless. So I've been watching a lot of Sex Education, the Netflix TV show, which is has that amazing mix of like, it's not really set now, but it's not set in the future, and it's not set in the 80s, even though it looks like this weird mix of like all of that. So that's kind of been on my mind in a way, to like not have like any specific like, especially modern fashion sense, or it's not 80s and it's not sort of modern day, or so all like the cars and the backgrounds are all like a little bit old looking, and it's not necessarily like modern like technology going on sometimes, but then they all the kids have phones and stuff, so I try and do that with it. And then
nice, I guess future proofing, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's it, but it, yeah, so it's just kind of not grounding it on one period, and then it just like in years, a few years time, it'll kind of, you know, a teenager couldn't read it then and go like, this isn't relevant to me now. So I kind of try and keep that in mind. So like Sex Education was a one I was always kind of had back in the back of my mind, and I guess you can't not relate this to Stranger Things at the moment as well, especially like with the season two where it's like they have that sort of monster with the kid for a bit, but it goes in a very, very different direction to that. It's just that you can't help but like have Stranger Things and like Paper Girls in your back of your mind when you look at our book, but it's very, very different.
Well, I think there's so many high school influences that always have been available in the kind of the mass mind, the mainstream storytelling media. And what's even stranger is obviously for Chris and I, being Brits, the things that would seem totally obvious and very everyday to those of you who came up through the US high school system seem a little bit strange and exotic to us. And so if we didn't have very reliable friends and editors to guide us and help us, we'd be relying almost entirely on high school movie cliches. So there's a version of this whole story, and sort of the way the pitch began was its headers with a super predator. And it was just and that's a really funny, and immediately you want to read that story. But I will tell you this, because I spent a long time thinking about it, that's a story that lasts one issue, and you have a great time with that one issue, and then you're on to the next story. Whereas as a result of a whole host of stuff, most particularly the fact that when Chris designed these characters, they all kind of just stepped off the page and started living and breathing, we realized that we would be doing them and ourselves and our readers a disservice by making this as obvious as that, by making a one-line joke. And what sort of evolved and took us by surprise was that The real story is not about these three kids who find an incredibly dangerous monster in the woods. I mean, by the way, there's a whole separate story where the logline is three kids find a gun in the woods. And what happens next? Huh. And that's the same story as three kids find an alien super predator in the woods. And again, that's a cool story, but it's a short story. And that's not the story I wanted to tell, because almost immediately we found that these three characters, like all teenagers, complicated and likable and unlikable and funny and awful and cruel and kind, and all the things that all human beings are, but especially teenagers, because they're human beings turned up to 11. And when you have those three characters jumping off the page, they want to be explored. And the thing that we quickly hit upon was, what if you allow them to hear each other's thoughts? It's that simple. The mechanism of discovering this thing in the woods, even before they realize that it's an actual living, breathing alien, is that it joins their brains. Suddenly they can hear each other's minds. They can't stop sharing each other's thoughts. And you get an awful lot of drama and an awful lot of very interesting, angry teenage stuff out of that mechanism alone. So it's not really like any high school story that I've seen, but it started in that very fertile soil, the sort of breakfast clubby, stranger theme, ET, you know, name any high school movie you've seen, there's a bit of it in there.
It's so funny how we're so quick to be like, it's Breakfast Club meets E.T. or whatever, you know what I mean? Mm. Does that offend you when folks, you know, pop that off on Twitter or whatever, or do you like this?
Because, yeah, I mean, there's a reason it's called an elevator pitch. If I've got 30 seconds to persuade you to read my story, then I'm probably going to lie. And it doesn't necessarily have to be an obvious lie, but it's a contraption. It's a way of making you go, holy shit, that sounds great. And then ideally you sit down and read it. Actually, it's not really what I said at all, but it's enough that I'm not lying to you outright, but it's something completely different and unexpected, and that's what we wanted to do, and I think have succeeded in doing with Alienated. In as much as I can tell you it's a story about three kids who find an alien in the woods, and I'm not lying to you, but that is so what the story is about.
right. I love how distinct each of the characters' voices is, and I'm always marveling at this kind of thing because, you know, personally, I'm always just thinking in my own head, how do you capture a different sort of voice between these three different characters?
I mean, it's a really boring answer. I say everything out loud. I drive my wife mad sitting in my talking out loud. I'm not the best when it comes to accents, but as long as you stick to your guns, even if other people are hearing it very differently, as long as every voice sounds the same to you whenever you do that same character's voice, then you're automatically going to be differentiating between them. And you know, there's a little bit of people we know in each of these characters, there's a little bit of archetypes that we're familiar with in TVs and movies, but what's really lovely about all three of them, I think, is that when you first meet them in issue one, we sort of do a kind of crash course introduction and some really cool slightly experimental storytelling that Christian's handled beautifully to kind of introduce them all in short order. So that by the end of issue one, I think we all know they're quite complicated characters, but we still feel like we sort of got a handle on them, only to discover in issues 2, 3, and 4 and onwards that we really don't know them at all, and they've all got hidden depth. So the real trick is sort of starting from a position that the voice of your characters feels honest and earnest because you know what's going on at the back of their brains, even though the readers don't. And it's a challenge. And in my case, all I can do is sit here yammering out loud and annoying the neighbors. And
to really get Alienated's pacing and tone, and especially I think I was struck by knowing you guys are British writers and artists, and us, myself being an American reading it, that there's this kind of very familiar small town rural feel to it that seems almost universal. Did you guys grow up in communities similar to the one in Alienated, or was it a new challenge to write something like mundane middle America?
Myself, I grew up in Liverpool City, so but not in the city centre though. I'm sort of in a town outside of it. So I'm from a sort of similar school background. Like again, like if I could relate it to anything, anyone would know it'd be like sex education. Again, is like that's kind of like my background, sort of, but not as hilly and tree-y.
Mine's extremely boring. I grew up in the home counties, which is like when you hear my voice and you imagine the BBC newsreader delivering the lines in her perfectly clipped English, maybe with Hugh Grant hovering in the background getting a blowjob off a prostitute. That's basically where I Queen's English, jumped over the blah, 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 all that stuff. So not really Middle America.
But I
guess the point is we have all at times in our lives experienced what it is to be an outsider. You know, even as you will see with our story, even the people who are most popular, if you ask them, would understand and relate to the idea of not always belonging. That is, I think, maybe one of the most universal experiences of fantasy and particularly of teenage life. So the location of it all, the kind of the small town quintessential Middle America-iness of it all, speaks to some of the kind of driving anger, especially of one of the characters, a character called Samuel, who he's our sort of angry pseudo-political firebrand who thinks he's got all the answers, and he thinks that America is ignorant and stupid and going down the toilet because everybody's content to just stick their heads in the ground and drink their beer and go back to sleep. So he's kind of a little mini Bill Hicks character. And for that anger to work, it made very good sense for him to be constantly stuck in a succession of nothing towns where he feels totally cut off from the grinding gears of the real world. And you know what, even having lived in multiple giant cities and now more recently well outside of the cities, that I think is also something that we can all relate to, feeling like we're out of control, feeling like we don't have any influence over the things that secretly, if somebody just gave us the opportunity, we definitely would be able to fix. So it all kind of fits in with the grand central theme, which is these three kids who each in their own way has ideas about what to do in order to improve the world, feeling like they have never been given the opportunity to do so, suddenly realizing that that's the chance that they have, and kind of fucking it up all over the place because it's not as simple as it seems.
Si, you did a really fantastic Twitter thread breaking down kind of, I love the insight into the different characters' voices and the monologues, the colors and all that stuff. I was really struck by kind of the very end of your Twitter thread where you referred to the alien creature revealed at the end of this first issue as terrifying and yet liking to cuddle. Can you tell us a bit about balancing scares and warmth in your storytelling? I think it's also really prevalent in, like, say, Coda.
Any heightened emotional sensation in a story immediately loses its power if you lean into it for too long. It's that simple. This is why the best horror films have a little bit of comic relief in between the scenes or a little bit of romance. It's why sexy movies and horror combine so well, because they're both interrelated but very distinct forms of heightened emotion. You can just bounce backwards and forwards between the two of them without people ever coming down from their state of heightened tension. With Alienated, and in fact, I think with any sort of honest, heartfelt, again, probably most especially teenage-centric stories, if you're going to be honest about your character's feelings, then that's going to be intense. And it's going to be exhausting if you just do nothing but batter your readers with 22 pages of teenage angst. You know, nobody really wants that. Nor do they really want 22 pages of aliens and bizarre, psychedelic, strange experiences. They may think that that's what they want, but actually, you can trust me on this, that gets old really quick. But to chop and change between the two, to start from a really mundane, recognizable place and then dive into something totally bizarre, and then back again to flip-flop between big scares and big laughs or whatever, there's always a different flavor that doesn't require you to turn down the momentum. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. It makes me think about pacing. It's always so key, especially in a single issue format, to speed up or slow down as the needs require. I'm wondering how. I know that you also in that same Twitter thread talked about the text blocks and how you can use that for pacing. I'm curious, when you're pacing out the book, is there a level of work done at the script and then the art, and then maybe even adding or changing dialogue or captions later on after the art's already in?
All of the above. And I'll sort of turn over to my esteemed colleague to talk about pacing. He will understand this far better than I ever will. But yeah, we layer it, every single step, building up and building up and building up and never ceasing to fiddle and change.
I'd say, yeah, exactly. On every level, we're always tweaking the pace. With any comic you go through, you get the script in, you get the layouts done, and then ink it and pencil it, and pencil and ink it, and then hand off to the colorist, and then the letterer, and then everyone's tweaking it as they go along. I mean, I don't have a lot of say on the book after I've handed in the artwork and the colors have been done. I give a little bit of feedback on the colors, but we kind of let Andre just do his thing for a lot of the time. We work very closely with the editor Eric, and he's definitely the sort of puppet master of this whole book, I think, and like sort of putting us in, like, you know, guiding us on a sort of a good route of how these things evolve and develop. And he knows, I think, aside from Sai, he's the only one who knows the sort of grand picture, like, you know, the overall thing. Like, I know where it's going to end, but I don't know the sort of mini sort of skips that we're going to do as the issues go on, because I'm up to halfway through it at the moment.
You may not know this, but I've literally finished writing issue 6, which means the whole thing is available to read if you wanted to.
I've been given up to 5, so definitely. Sorry, our little business meeting in the middle of the podcast.
Oh, no. That's exciting.
I've always wondered, Chris, because like when you turn in art and then Andre turns in colours, and then Jim, our incredible letterer, will do a first pass of the lettering. Well, actually, what normally happens is I'll get a PDF of the finished art, either in inked form or in coloured form, if we're ahead of the game, and I'll tweak the script. Make a lettering script, which then goes off to Jim, our letterer. And then generally his first pass in the lettering will come back to me, and I'll through it and request any tweaks or changes, and the editors will look for any typos or grammars, or they'll point out any notes and say things like, you can't say this, it's ridiculously offensive, what's wrong with you? And that's I've always wondered whether we're sort of missing a step, which is when the first pass on the lettering is done and the editors forward it to me to make all my tweaks and fiddles, shouldn't we also be sending it to the artist? In as much as you might have some important feelings about positioning of balloons or eye track or any of that stuff. I mean, is that something that boils your gut? Do you often sit down and read a comic you've technically been as responsible as anybody for making, only to discover that it's been ruined by people?
I've got to say, no, I've never really worried about it too much, because I've been very lucky to be in good hands with editors and writers and stuff, and like it's all people who seem to be on the right level with. I think this is the first book that I've ever worked on that I've only because I realized that nobody ever gives my layouts to the letterer, which is the main place. That's where I work out where I think speech bubbles are going to go. And I know, I know some people do it, or like some artists will have a say on it. Like I think I forget the name of the artist on the Mark Miller Wanted book, but in the back of that, the artist has notes on where lettering should go on that. So I think some people do it, but yeah, I've worked with Jim Campbell quite a lot, and when we started working on Alienated, I asked him, do you ever see my layouts? Because I was curious, and he said, I've never seen any of your layouts before. So this is the first time, and like every time I finish my layouts, I just send him the PDF and just go, here's what I had in mind. But Jim, I have total trust in Jim to, you know, if he's got a better way of doing it, then just let him do his thing. But then, he said to me recently that it was good because he finally saw where, like, if he thinks that that's a section, like on a panel, if there's a section that he thinks I'm trying to save for art and he doesn't want to cover it up with a bubble, he can now see where I intend that to go. Because I tend to put quite detailed pages down, so it probably to him might always look like, oh, I can't cover that up. But a lot of the time, a lot of the time it's me just putting filler in, even if it doesn't get seen. But in terms of me seeing how the story plays out afterwards, and you know, with the whole story pulled together, I don't know. I'm always quite trusting with that, in that it's, I don't feel like I need to see it. I mean, I'd be happy to, like, if an editor wanted to get my feedback on it. But a lot of the time, I feel like I've done all I can, and I've done enough.
You know, there's that terrible cliche these days where you see a little bit of YouTube footage of the actors doing the read-through of the script of the finale episode, like Game of Thrones or whatever it is. And they're all sitting there and they're reading it out loud, and they're reading it for the first time while they're reading out loud. And there's all gasps and wonderment as they finally realise what's happening to their character. I sort of want to believe it's like that, where like you've spent a month drawing issue 5 and then you sit down to read issue 6, because of course you've been good enough not to read ahead. And you're gasping with your coffee.
I got to say, when I read issue 3 of Alienated, I was sat in my front room when I finished it. I went, ooh, I turned to my wife Laura and said, that was really good. But yeah, I tend to just read through it, just and scribbling and making notes, and not putting much out in the world as I'm reading. I don't know. Yeah, but yeah, definitely. Si knows this, that issue 3 is one of my favorite scripts I've ever been given to work on any book, that one was definitely an outstanding one where I was like, oh, that's really good. But I mean, 2 as well, and 1, like, I was quite excited with them all, but 3 was the one that made me push out some language into the world.
we sort of discovered new things about our characters and the story we thought we were telling at every step, which is, I like to think that's a good sign that the characters are interesting and fertile, and the setup of the story is interesting and fertile, in that you can be surprised by all the ingredients while you're cooking. Wonderful.
It's a discovery process.
Yeah.
When designing the visual language of Alienated, how many iterations did it take to get the quote-unquote super predator or its runic language right? Did you go through a lot of different looks and feels?
Did I take this, Si?
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, it wasn't that hard, really. I meant to look up where I got the language, like the language he has that hovers over his head is like, it changes. It's got 2 sort of modes. So while he's super young, he's got this sort of simplified version of it, and then when he gets older he has the same symbols but they're a bit more complicated, but they're all based on this like sphere of emotions, like certain, like a, it was like a chart of emotions that this I forget if he was a philosopher or a psychiatrist who sort of said that these are the sort of key emotions that people have. And then I did a range of sort of runes and languages based on that sort of short set, and then added a few more that I thought could go in. And I think but it's kind of like a mix of like weird, like hermetic and just like old Viking runes and stuff like that, and just some just made up. So and I think I did three passes at it. I think I did one. I just did one little set when we were first sort of working out what chip was. And can I say chip? I think that's the thing I can't say, isn't it?
His name is Chip.
For reasons, yeah.
The alien's language. the alien's language, yeah. Is when we were trying to work him out and what he looked like, or it looks like. That was just an extra thing I threw on, because I was kind of gave him this slightly like Mayan sort of face mask look, because we were playing around with the idea that he'd have this mask. And then I thought, I didn't know if he was going to speak in the book at that point, I think. So I kind of thought, oh, maybe we can, to give him a sort of emotion and like a way to sort of like a hidden way to get things across, maybe we could do this. And then Cy and Eric seemed to like it, and then we've kept it. And then from what I've seen, we're using it as a sort of theme for each book as well. It's kind of just like been a small idea, and then I've just kind of played around with runes and mixing together a few different languages and things like that, until I've just kind of made this sort of set that all look similar, and they all sort of crown his head. So when he's older, it sort of, they sort of circle his head like in an arc a little bit.
Uh-huh. Can I just say, I cannot think of any other artist who, when given the challenge of designing a genuinely alien for comics, takes it upon himself to just go and casually create a whole new language.
Fool. The damn fool.
It's funny you said, you know, you're calling it a super predator, but I was like, oh, it's so cute. It's almost like a cat in its cuteness.
Yeah.
We've done our job then. you've been lured in.
Oh, no, it's going to strike.
What we really wanted was, and this is to kind of go back to the E.T. analog, we're so familiar with the idea of aliens being just little green men, literally, you know, little people who are really just like us, and they remind us of ourselves, and they're either scary or heartwarming. What we really wanted to do was something truly ineffable, something that felt genuinely alien. This is not necessarily a physical creature. This is not necessarily a creature that thinks, feels, eats, pukes. It doesn't necessarily do anything that we do. And we sort of discover over the course of the whole series that it's sort of mimicking the ways and whys of the people who found it, these three kids. But as Christian has just been saying, there is a sort of universality of emotion which speaks to the simple day-to-day, how you operate as a living creature. You feel threatened, you feel as though you've done something right, and you need a signal reward for that. All these amazing things over chip with sort of displaying that. It's really, really clever.
Nice. Yeah, okay, so quickly, and maybe I'm completely off here, but the base premise of this series feels like it could go in a political direction. Is that at all accurate, or am I way off?
You're not way off. It's just one of the myriad things that we're going to be looking at. And to qualify that slightly, if you've read issue one, you know that of the three kids, there's one of them who's really, really interested in the state of the world. And there's one of them who probably should be interested in the state of the world, but just wants to bury her head in the sand. And there's one who seems to be totally disinterested in the state of the world. And those three arcs, each of which has major surprises along the way, will be radically complicated by, as I keep saying, the initiating question of what would you do if you could change the world? And the kid who thinks he knows all the answers to the world's problems, whose name is Samuel, takes a very interesting and frankly quite dark journey into answering that question.
Interesting. Great.
Kind of continue that thread, or to turn it on its head for you. When you were young and idealistic, like the kids in Alienated, what did you think you would be when you grew up?
Christian, you need to handle that one.
Fireman. yeah, God, I think I've always wanted to be... I used to call it a cartoonist when I was younger, but I've always wanted to be an artist of some description, drawing characters and, so I guess, telling a story. Like, I wanted to make cartoons and films and stuff. But, yeah, Fireman was definitely... definitely up there, and then it's just always been an artist ever since school, I think. That's about it.
I write comics for a living. When people ask me, what are you going to do when you grow up, I still don't have an answer to that.
Is there a particular time and place you guys write and draw?
All day. It's the nature of the job quite a lot, I think. For me, it's just I work from home, so it's kind of wake up and then, you know, do some chores around the house and then start work and then work until the end of the day usually. But I don't have a specific sort of setup for drawing. Maybe writing might be different.
Yeah, it's broadly the same. It's whenever I've got nothing else happening. That's weirdly enough, I have an 18-month-old baby, and so my life has suddenly become so much more regimented than it was before. One thing I've always felt is a little bit cruel about being a writer, and I think this is probably true of anybody in any creative field, is that you're never really relaxed, you're never really not working. Mm-hmm. And come to terms with that. Now, when I go on a very rare vacation, when I'm sitting on the beach, this speculative, hypothetical vacation that never actually fucking happens, but let's pretend his Cy Pasty Spurrier sitting on the beach like a beluga whale. Even then, I'm churning through story ideas, and mm-hmm. I've trained myself, or maybe I'm lucky enough that I didn't have to. That's fun. That's how I chill out, is just thinking up stuff and filling notebooks, to the extent that sometimes I just can't read fiction anymore because I would rather be scribbling notes. Mm. Yeah, I guess
it's a curse.
Well, it sort of is, but at the same time, we're doing exactly what we love, and it would be desperately disingenuous and frankly unfair to people who do jobs that they despise to pretend that we're suffering as a result. You know, there's plenty of people in the world who work at least as hard as we do, doing things that they really don't want to be doing, so we shouldn't complain. Right. But we do, because we're human.
I read in an interview you did with, I think, The Comics Beat, that you write insane nonsense for Bilquis Evely in The Dreaming, and I was curious, Chris, how much insane nonsense is Cy writing for you to articulate in the art?
Yeah, I think... That's one thing I've bonded with Bilquis over on Twitter a few times recently. Is the yeah, I've first hand knowledge of what it is to do a double page spread for Cy now. It's
comparing their scars, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a thing of beauty and pain. It's great. I love it. Like I do love a challenge. Like I'd be bored off my ass if I had to just do talking head pages all the time. But Cy has a really beautiful writing style where he just throws a ton of stuff at you, but in a good way, and it makes sense when you sit down. I gotta say, sometimes you read stuff for the first time and you're like, how the fuck am I gonna do any of this? but then when you like reread it and just like sit and think about it, and you just turn your comic brain on, it's like, yeah, this will work. And it's stupid the way it works, because it's just like, it doesn't look like it should work, but then when you pull it together, it's like, oh, this works really well. So there's, I think on the second issue, there's this mad like sort of dream sequence bit that's filled with these panels on the outside that are like set in the normal world with the kids talking, but then they jump into this dream bit in the middle, and it just goes absolutely bonkers. And there's the amount of stuff that's going on, it just, when you first read it, you're like, this shouldn't work, but when it's pulled together, it's actually worked out really well. So it is good. I love it. I love a challenge, and Cy's definitely up for putting an artist through their paces, but it's good. You know, you can't it makes the job worthwhile, really. stuff like that. So, yeah, I like it. But I do feel for Bilquis because I think she's got a heavier job than I do, definitely. I'm absolutely a big, big fan of Bilquis as well. And I don't know how she does it. And she does it traditionally as well. Yeah. So, yeah, she's nuts.
Cannot rant about her enough. And it's funny, I mean, with those two books especially, I mean, I've been so lucky recently with the artists I work with. But with Alienated and with The Dreaming especially, I've been spoiled in as much as I can give relatively little visual description for something that is absolutely monumentally psychedelic, batshit strange, in the knowledge that either artist will respond to the challenge, as Christian's just been saying, in such a way that it makes perfect sense eventually. If I ever have to do another book that's full of occasional psychedelic double page spreads, I'm going to be fucked because I won't know what to say if I can't guarantee that my artist is just going to figure it out for themselves. So yeah, I've sort of made a rod for my own back there.
So changing pace just a little bit. If Alienated had a poster similar to the famous Hang in There Cat poster, what would it read?
I'm going to leave that to the Wordmeister.
It would be a picture of a human head sliced open across the top with Chip, the little alien, guzzling his way through the contents of the brains, and it would say, "Don't die."
Interesting.
Goddamn super predator indeed. Please.
Okay, so we're going to move away from the interview portion right now. We're going to go into a segment we call Super Fight, where we pit characters against each other, and we pull a random card from a deck called Super Fight, a game called Super Fight. And I have selected E.T. versus Alien versus your Super Predator. And we have to determine who would be better at mud wrestling. Who would win at mud wrestling, all three going at it?
Oh, jeez.
Oh. I got to say, like, knowing what Chip can do... Oh, fuck, I've said it again.
Yeah.
knowing what our little dude can do, I think he's going to wrap him up and beat him down because he's not necessarily stuck to his little form. He's he can do whatever he wants. And
ooh, interesting.
I think he can...
He immediately wants a cuddle from E.T. because he doesn't, right? And
oh, yeah,
while he's having a cuddle with E.T., along comes the alien and obviously rips E.T. to shreds. Because
right, yeah.
Before in a dreadful, traumatized state, he's not having that. He just, you know, snaps his fingers, changes reality. Xenomorph gets sprayed across 400 dimensions.
Oh, man.
Well, let's not rule out that E.T. can make his fingers glow.
See, I was going to say I thought Chip would end up killing... Oh, fuck, I've done it again. I was going to say I think our dude would kill E.T. because I read recently somebody asking what you think E.T. would actually smell like. And I can imagine Chip... Our dude would probably smell E.T. and go, no, and just squeeze him into oblivion because he's just probably smells like hot cat food, I imagine.
That's something I never thought about. That's great. We have one more segment. It's called Off Topic Top Shelf. This is where we ask you guys what you're into right now that's not comics related. It can be books. It can be movies. It can be something you like eating right now. Whatever floats your boat right now.
I actually have a good answer to this for a change. I found recently that I didn't really realize that this was me, but I noticed suddenly that I'm one of those people who reads about 5 or 6 books all at the same time. And that sounds like a crime, you know. I feel like a good book, you should open it and read it. But actually, the number of reference books and fiction books and non-fiction books, I sort of start reading something and then sometimes I'll just find something new and read that cover to cover and then go back or whatever it is. So I've got like 5 or 6 books on the go at any one time. And the antidote to the sheer stress and overwhelming madness that that inflicts upon me is a magazine that I get every month called 14 Times, which I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's amazing. It's a magazine for people who describe themselves as 14s, that is, people who subscribe to the views of Charles Fort, who was a gentleman who essentially made it his mission to collect weird news.
Huh.
And the way I would characterize 14 Times is that it's written by and for optimistic skeptics, which is to say somebody who really secretly wants there to be aliens and Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster and gibbering African sun gods and any other sort of strange folkloric sci-fi weirdness that you can imagine, but isn't prepared to believe that it's out there just because somebody tells you it is. And that's 14 Times, and it's brilliant. It's full of some extraordinary stories and extraordinary tales from all over the world, and it triggers my imagination like nothing else.
Mine's not going to be anywhere near as intellectual as that. I'm totally sucked into PUBG at the moment, which is my only sort of escape.
Oh my god, me too!
Really? Oh no way!
I've got about 1,000 hours into it. It's the only game I play.
Oh god, yeah, that and checking to see if I've killed streamers on it and seeing them freak out.
There's a website you can check and watch you yourself kill them. It's awesome.
Yeah. So that's my big escape from work at the moment is just if I've got free time from work, I'll go and play that. And like I'm big on games, so I play like a bunch of games. I don't know. I'm recently mostly a vegetarian, and I'm slowly becoming more vegetarian as time goes on. So I'm loving Jamie Oliver's cookbook at the moment. Me and my wife are slowly working our way through each recipe on it, and it's not been a downer so far, which is good. And that's it.
Nice.
Sorry, I feel like an absolute twat after you just come up with this amazing one. I'm definitely going to try out.
Gaming thing. My wife and I try very hard to couch co-op, but there are so few games that allow you to do that. Like Borderlands 3, we're up to now, is the one we've been playing recently, which is an absolute blast. But I mean, this is all very granular and uninteresting, but they've changed it so that you can only have the split screen in verticals. No, in horizontals. That's right. The camera is horizontal, which makes it really, really difficult to play. So we're kind of on the verge of giving up on that, I think, which is a great shame.
Hmm.
That is a shame. Chris, Sai, thank you so much for your time. This was a blast. And Alienated #1 is out February 12th from Boom Studios.
It sure is. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much, guys. That's great.